Okay, our next presentation is Human Fatigue and Impairment: Predicting, Detecting, and Mitigating. Our presenter's Josh Savitt. He's Senior Manager, Predictive Safety. Josh has been involved in mine safety and regulatory compliance for the past 10 years. He's one of the founders of Predictive Compliance, a data management and benchmarking tool that has become an industry standard in the MSHA environment. For the past 3 years, he's been working with Predictive Safety in the fatigue and fit for duty arena. He has spent time in South Africa, Namibia, Peru, Chile, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. working with mining and safety groups on the issues of fatigue and fit for duty. How about a warm welcome for Josh?
Well, as you can see, I did this presentation on April 25th already, so it is a little dated, but not too bad. One of the things that we're going to talk about today, and continuing with these great words like ingress and egress and GUI, is circadian rhythms. And a key factor into this is fatigue is a natural occurrence. The body is determined and regulated by its circadian cycle. Fatigue honestly cannot be related. Cannot be eliminated. It cannot be controlled without active management. And what we're going to talk about more and more, sorry, I can't see my own screen, and if I turn that way, I can't necessarily get to it, so I'm going to talk like this so I can see the screen. Management, education, measurements, and monitoring. That's the key factors that we have to include into here. What I'm going to show you right now is an actual incidency point that came off of the Kolomela iron mine in South Africa. What you'll see in this is these are incidents that occurred, and we have two times as many incidents during the day shift, and we have 10 times as costly incidents at the night shift. So each number represents a dollar in US thousands. Now, if you can see the color variation in this, these are actual fatigue transition zones. So these are the areas where the body itself is transitioning from one stage of fatigue to another. Our approach is changing the way that we have normally look at fatigue. Right now, in the mining industry specifically, we are using monitoring systems to mitigate fatigue. How many people in this room use some kind of eyesight monitor in their equipment on their mine sites? Those of you who are operators. Does anybody use a GuardVant, DSS, SmartCap? I could go down the laundry list of what we refer to as point of failure systems. Doesn't mean that they're bad systems, they are point of failure systems. How many do fatigue training? Does everybody do fatigue training? How many people do fatigue education? And I define those as different words. Education and training are not the same thing. The other thing is how many people do monitoring. People know that there's actually fatigue monitoring systems that exist out there as well. Currently, like I said, the majority, the bulk of it, is full-on point of failure monitoring. What we now are trying to do is do a more monitor control, fit for duty, and education model. Now, this works in conjunction with all of the technologies that are out there and available. The education of fatigue, and I have to thank Steve for putting me right here at the lowest fatigue level that all of us naturally have. So we are absolutely in the most tired, most distracted point of our day. I don't think any of us really want to be in a conference at about 8:30 tonight where we're at our actual most alert stage. And then ironically, we have a very long but drastic dip to that night shift when we have our deepest sleep again. Now again, if you're working in a shift pattern 24-hour cycle where you might be working the night shift, you are again going to have that deep drop. But your circadian rhythms will actually be shifted based on when you go to sleep and when you wake up. So every time you get regenerative sleep, and that means you get sleep over 6 hours, and that's the amount of time it takes your brain to actually regroup, you can reduce and move the circadian rhythm back to the normal by 1 hour. So if you think about how many days you need to recover by working on the night shift to actually bring you back, that's why airlines monitor fatigue so drastically. Again, what is fatigue? We can go through this slide, and I'm not going to try to go through all 37 slides I have in 20 minutes, but this is just a quick overview. A lot of different things happen. But more importantly, it's how it affects everything. Shift rosters can cause it. Work culture can cause it. Individual characteristics can cause it. Private commitments, skills, knowledge, environment, nature of work, the list goes on and on. And then when you add in something as simple as distraction, both positive and negative, and this is really something I focus on from a safety and health point of view, we in this room look at behavior and we look primarily at negative behavior. But if an employee walks into your site and says, guess what? I'm getting married. How many of you go, that employee is a safety risk? That employee is distracted. Then add in there that they might have been up all night contacting family. They might not have gotten the appropriate sleep. It's a lot of factors that play into this. And I have to tell you that I'm relatively passionate because I've started to learn more and more about this. And of course, being a parent of a six-year-old, I had no clue, because I only really started doing it 3 years ago, what my body was doing when I was spending up all night with my daughter who had acid reflux and couldn't sleep in anything but her bouncy chair. You know, and a wife who got no sleep, and I got no sleep, and having to have conference calls. And then all of a sudden you realize that you're standing there and you don't even think about using your oven mitt to take the pan out of the oven that you've had in there because you were cooking dinner, and you have a really nice burn mark on the bottom of your hand. Or the other thing of how excited you are that it's close to your child's birthday and you end up missing a conference call. Simple things like that that we, for lack of a better term, to quote my father, who some of you know, call a brain fart. But it's distraction. It's fatigue. It's natural, but it can be mitigated. The measurement aspect of it. And because we are in a technical session, I did really try to actually create a fatigue algorithm. And I'm happy to send this to everybody, but this is actually a fatigue algorithm. This is widely used in the fatigue science world. You can't manage what you don't measure. And we talk about measurement, and it's kind of our tagline from our company, so I throw it in there. Shift patterns, break patterns, countermeasures, commute times, hydration, all of these are factors that can mitigate fatigue. They cannot alleviate fatigue. They can mitigate fatigue. Does anybody know the only actual action that can actually eliminate fatigue? Shout it out. Come on. Let's have some fun. Sleep. Yeah. Sleep. Here's an interesting fact for all of you who travel internationally. If you want to really piss off your boss, tell them that you cannot get fully regenerative sleep unless you are in a horizontal format. Therefore, you are required to have a lay flat sleep for all international transatlantic or transpacific flights. It is scientifically proven that you cannot sleep like this. You have to be laying down. It still doesn't even work for my own company, and we're fatigue guys. The desynchronization of sleep cycle and circadian rhythms. This happens instantly. By 3 days of a 12-hour shift, you are desynchronized. By Thursday, you are technically working in a state of jet lag. Some of you I know have traveled quite a distance to get here and have been fighting jet lag. Some of you are only 1 hour different than where you were. But that issue of that desynchronization of your circadian rhythms, that is jet lag, that is a big factor in how fatigue builds up. You build up sleep debt, and a lot of our employees go home after work, and they turn around, and they come, and they go, oh, yeah, I went home. How many hours did you sleep? Oh, I got some sleep, but I also fed the cattle or worked on the farm, or we had a race that night, and my kid had a soccer game. So what you find out is they worked an 8-hour shift, they had an hour commute, and they did family stuff, then they had other obligations, they went to sleep at midnight, got up at 5 to be back at the mine site at 6. So they got 5 hours of sleep, we don't even know what the quality of the sleep is, we're going to put them in a multi-million dollar vehicle that can crush the other multi-million dollar vehicles in a heartbeat. And we're relying solely in the early stages on equipment that looks at the eyes or measures their movement or measures the gimbal of the truck. We can't just rely on point of failure. We have to start actually managing it from a predictive nature. This, again, is what I was kind of discussing in the jet lag format. And I'll happily share this slide deck with anybody who wants it. Obviously, the effects of fatigue, slow reaction, auto response, poor decision making, forgetfulness, poor communication, microsleeps. None of these, with the exception of microsleeps, can be detected by that point of failure system. Let me give you a little bit of science to go into this. Our brains process 100 actions per second. It tells us how to move our hands, it tells us how to react, it tells us what to look at. It's not telling us to breathe, it's not telling our muscles how to work, it's not reminding us our hair to grow. That's all in the rote actions, and those are over 10,000 that are actively working. Any of you who have younger kids under the age of 12 can go, I wonder why my 10-year-old just tripped and there was nothing there to trip. Even at that stage at 10, their rote actions aren't fully developed, so their actual process actions are currently taking place. So they may trip for no apparent reason because, guess what, they didn't pay enough attention and that 100 actions wasn't working fast enough. When you get fatigued, those 100 actions start to shrink. Your peripheral vision shrinks. So the more tired you get, the more the rote actions get. So when you get to that level of absolute exhaustion, guess what? You can still drive home. You're not going to remember anything you saw. You're not going to remember possibly going to the store even and picking up the milk that your wife or your husband asked you to get on the way home. But you will make it home and you will be fine. By the time you are aware of how tired you are, you have absolutely entered a danger area in this manner. There is no objective standard for defining fatigue until the point of failure. Fatigue is a non-static variable, making different to measure because we are all individuals. There are people out there called short sleepers. They sleep about 4 hours a night maximum, and they seem to function fine. What the short sleepers don't tell you is that about once every 14 days, they sleep for 8 to 10 hours. And I know this because I'm one of them. I sleep about 4 hours a night, and then about one day every 10 days, I need a solid 8 hour sleep, and I sleep sound as can be. This is the metric for fatigue. This is the standard that we currently use. And it's pretty widely used, you know, throughout the entire industry. What we've talked about, point of failure, is the severe area. That's when you are aware that you are exhausted. Now, if everybody can think back to that slide that I showed earlier, most of those incidents occurred in this area, in the transition zones. And this is the amazing thing about the brain. It can compensate for these transitions, but it takes time to compensate for the transitions. So you are aware that you are tired, so you compensate for it, but you're not aware that you've transitioned from one state to another. So if you're not aware of these transition points, you can't mitigate the transition points. This is just a different way that we can look at it, and this is how we utilize our system to best communicate that. At the low risk, you're going to work. At the moderate fatigue risk, notifications can begin. You can utilize countermeasures. Every time I talk about countermeasures, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory made a list of over 160 countermeasures for NASA on how to deal with astronauts being in space. Anybody want to guess what the number one countermeasure is on that? And it's not sleep. Water. Drinking water. So when we go pitch our system and pitch our education system and talk about this, the first thing that somebody usually says at any site, whether it be mining or heavy industry or transportation or shipping, is goes, you want me to pay you to tell my staff how to drink water? And I look at them and I go, do you supply free water to them? No. No, I don't want you to pay me to tell your staff how to drink water. I want you to pay me to tell you to supply water. Real simple. If you don't supply water, they can't drink water. You know, how many people have worked in Africa? How easy is it to get a bottle of water at a site in Africa? How easy is it to get a Coca-Cola in Africa? Real easy. Or a bottle of tonic water? Really easy. Not good countermeasures. You know, satisfying, but not going to be helpful. So again, when you get into this high risk in the red area, you're talking about mandatory countermeasures and mandatory supervisor notification. None of this is effective, in my opinion, if you're not educating, not training, but educating the employees on why. Going back, well, the back doesn't work. Okay, never mind. Okay, there we go. Going back to this simple education of where you stand. Why are we doing this? We're doing this because in a significant and shielded defensive area in fatigue, you actually are 2 times more likely to have an incident. Just a simple transition point right there. More active. More likely. And then when you get into here, you're 10 times. Now, you know, you're not going to sit there and tell an employee you're going to cost me 10 times more money if you have an accident at that point. But by the time they get there, we know that they're actually now compensating it. They're less likely to have an accident with the piece of equipment that they're having, but they're more likely to do damage to something around them because their peripheral vision has shrunk, their reaction time is way down. So if you think about how many guys have clipped a mirror on a pickup truck on your site, that's a fatigue issue. That's an alertness issue. When we do RCAs, we don't necessarily ask about fatigue. We don't necessarily ask about alertness. What we ask about is, why'd you do this? I went into a mine and actually discussed with them about how we were going to do our system and why they should use this. And their answer to me was, we've had 3 fatigue-related incidents on the mine this year. I said, how do you know they're fatigue-related incidents? They said, because the driver was either asleep when we got to the vehicle, or they told us they fell asleep. I said, how many other incidents did you have? And they said, 50. And I said, okay, so you've had 53 alertness and fatigue-related accidents. And their answer is, well, I guess so, I don't know. And it's simple. They don't know because they don't know. We don't know when an employee is thinking about something else. We don't know when an employee is distracted. We don't know when an employee hasn't had enough sleep. We haven't created an environment necessarily for everybody to be able to communicate that or give our frontline supervisors the tools to go that route. Oh, sorry, I didn't talk about that slide because I was... Okay. Fatigue impacts the quality of the organization. We all agree on that, yes? Fatigue is inherent to all humans. We all agree on that. So if we can educate and define the process as a group to sit down and create a non-punitive, organic, holistic methodology that says this is why we are doing this. This is what you need to do. Creating the countermeasures. Does anybody here work at a site that bans energy drinks from site? Okay, that is a popular movement now. I won't tell you who had it, but there was an operation in the United States that airlifted an employee off of their site for severe, what looked like a severe heart attack. That employee had 0 food in his shift, and he drank 15 Monster energy drinks. Yeah. Guess what? You're gonna feel like you're having a heart attack. You know, I don't care how much you drink of that stuff. I drink coffee religiously. I still know I need to drink a lot of water on top of it. There are more and more companies starting to ban energy drinks. So if we can create the appropriate amount of hydration, coffee is a viable countermeasure. 1 cup of coffee, not 6. Remember, coffee is a diuretic. 6 cups of coffee is going to create a different kind of issue for you. Frequent exercise. And Lydia was, you know, nice enough to kind of allude to that based on Chris's initial question. These guys are sitting in their cab for 7 hours sometimes. What's wrong with a 5-minute break to get out and walk around the cab? It's going to help them. It's going to reduce any kind of incident in that point. Now, of course, if you listened to Lydia's talk too, you would have heard that you run a very high risk of them tripping off the ladder and falling down and having another issue. So you got to mitigate that in the possibilities. Even washing hands, cold face, you know, simple things like that. Here's another factor in this. When we initially did our first pilot with the Anglo mine at Columella, we found that specifically the female employees, but actually a majority of the employees, really shied away from the hydration, from the liquid countermeasures, whether it be a cup of coffee or a cup of water or anything like that. Does anybody want to take a guess why they didn't really want to do it? What? Bathrooms. Quality of bathrooms. When you think about your own site, do you think about your bathrooms being a safety and health factor? Do they actually create an environment that somebody wants to go into? Well, that has a cyclical effect in how you operate in this manner. Of course, monitoring food intake, caffeine. Yeah, having a Snickers bar is great. You know, those commercials are really funny. But the truth is they only last for about 30 minutes, and then you actually get a bigger problem after somebody's eaten the candy bar. These are just a variation of how we run the countermeasure operations. And I'm gonna wrap up here in a couple of minutes from the monitoring point of view. This is how our internal system works, and our system works in conjunction with the point of failure systems, in conjunction with the wearables, somebody putting on a bracelet or utilizing even their smartphone to monitor their exercise. But we take 14-day work history, entry and exit times, work times, and we can create a fatigue score. If we can get the employee buy-in, what we want to do is we want to have a sleep question. How much did you sleep? If you were in that 3 to 6 hours, that's kind of the average. 6 plus, you're great. We also have a psychomotor vigilance test, which is a video game that can actually show you what your alertness score is and build an individual baseline for every employee. I'm happy to demonstrate that test if somebody wants to see it. This is actually a dashboard off of our system showing you the department, the supervisor, what time they clocked in, where their fatigue status is now, where their fatigue status is, their next fatigue status, and what time that transition is going to occur. So as you can see, this transition will occur within 1 hour of this employee shift, and it's going to occur, I believe, at about 2:40-something, based on the piece. And the green check mark says this person has taken a countermeasure. It's kind of the whole verification process. These are actual shift deviations to show you the difference when you start to fatigue. This employee is working in high and severe on the last day of his shift versus a more compliant schedule. Of course, some places have strict, you know, 12-hour monitorings. So this is something that we can populate out of there, is how long a person's actually been on site for callouts. Obviously, utilizing the people and the technology. We have great success with the unions utilizing this because, again, core of it is it's not punitive. This is not used to fire an employee or send an employee home. It's used to figure out if the employee is truly fit for duty. Here's just a little bit of rate-by-rate information. What you can see is what the fatigue zones and where the accidents occur. And this is kind of the benefits of what we've managed to accomplish. 3% increase on the night shift. How many people would like to see a 3% increase on their night shift attendance? And then a reduction of over 35% per metric ton for LTIs. So that incident rate has dropped 35%. So here's kind of the up. Workers, supervisors that agreed with the fatigue risk monitoring. So you can see the before and the after was able to manage their own fatigue level. 46% said they could after they understood what we were saying, 80%. They thought that the fatigue management system would actually help them, and they feel better about their work environment. The average comment was this: I was always good, but I knew Steve was a little bad. But now that we're monitored, I know Steve's good, so I feel a little bit safer. And that's that. And like I said, I'll happily share this with anybody.
Push that in 25 minutes. Wow, that's amazing. So when I was at SME earlier this year, your group had a system, basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of like the Simon game where you follow a pattern of buttons. to determine the level of fatigue?
It's called the alert meter.
Okay.
That the system that Steve's talking about is called the alert meter. It's our psychomotor vigilance test. It's clinically proven for fatigue, clinically proven for alertness, and by the end of the summer, we will have it clinically proven for impairment, specifically for marijuana and other drug impairment process on it. So it's a non-intrusive piece. It's meant to let the employee understand their own baseline, not meant to utilize it as a tool to fire somebody. I just got to throw that in there. Thank you, Steve.
So that was the question that I had. Mm-hmm. You talked about index measurement, mm-hmm. but I never did see you tell me how you did that.
It's based off of the 14-day work history. We utilize what's called an Akerstedt 3 modeling system. It's very similar to what Jeppesen uses for all the airline pilots. And it utilizes, there's multiple brains to this. One is called FIRM, one is called REM. That brain, and that could take hours just to discuss the brain. Yeah, takes that in there. Then in the algorithm itself, it's got that 14-day work history, the algorithm, and then it's got shift profile. So if you're at a high-risk shift or a low-risk shift, it can move it around, and we map the circadian rhythm over onto that, and that's how it creates the index, and that's how it creates that dashboard.
So you track that on an employee?
By their clock-in, clock-out.
Clock-in, clock-out times.
Yep.
How do you understand if they had enough rest when they weren't at work?
We ask, you saw we had that one section that has the sleep question.
You request them to provide that information?
We do not mandate that. We request it.
Okay.
And where we utilize that in the voluntary form, we have over 80% participation. Where they are mandated, and you know, some operations do mandate it, they have about 60% compliance to it.
Thank you.
So explain to me why a person is generally more alert at 8:30 in the evening. I think a person that does a regular day job, you get home, you have supper, and you sit down, and that's when you're most tired.
It depends on what you have for dinner. I mean, nutrition is a huge factor in it. You know, sending, you know, mom or dad off to work the night shift on a stomach full of spaghetti and meatballs is a recipe for them going to sleep. That's a designed meal to help you go to sleep, honestly. The circadian rhythms, that alertness is at your peak alertness. It's not mean you're the most awake. It's your brain is at its peak alertness point. And then you saw it has a fairly rapid decline over that time frame. You may be very sleepy. How many people have laid down but can't go to sleep? Their brain is processing really fast at that time.
Excellent presentation. Son, excellent presentation. Thank you. And as an operating manager, you have me freaked out. But I'm just curious if you have a position or an operating theory on how much a device and usage of a device, smartphone or similar, impacts someone's level of fatigue.
You mean in terms of utilizing it while not working or utilizing it?
Just from the point of view of people are using it more often than ever, in my personal opinion.
I have an opinion on it. I don't have a scientific fact. I believe that utilizing a smartphone is relatively detrimental after a certain time of night. And that position is based on the fact that I give a 6-year-old an iPad at 8 o'clock at night because I need her to leave me alone, and she won't go to sleep. So, I mean, but I even know for myself, just the knowledge, I think even, it's not just the smartphone, it's the real-time technology today that we don't live in a world that shuts down anymore. So you can check your phone and your emails at any time of the day, or you could check the news and you could get locked into a riveting story and on it, and you can't go back to sleep. I personally have made a move to no longer have my phone by me at night, because I know when I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm gonna go to my phone and start looking. It's not just the alertness, it's the quality of sleep that it affects in that way.
I've actually read some articles in the health world around how foot
can... I've read some articles in the health industry about how utilization of these computers interrupt your sleep patterns, the light, and there's a bunch of research that's been done about that.
Great presentation. Okay, so